Okay, so I think we're live now. So thank you very much, everyone, for coming. Today we're in for a bit of a treat, as far as I'm concerned, because we've got all the experts in the various, three of the various formats, naming formats. There's two hard problems in computer science. One is cache and validation, and the other is naming. And naming and how we actually refer to things is what we're going to be talking about today. And so with that, I'd like to ask each of the panelists to introduce themselves and then talk about the use case of their format that they're representing for naming and the use cases. And if we could do a round robin, and then want to open it up for questions between panelists as well as the audience. And we will try to make sure we repeat the questions for the stream. And with that, I'll start off with Ava.
Thanks, Kate. Hello, folks. Hello, stream. Ava Black, currently leading open source security at CISA in the US, only for about 6 months. Please don't ask me any questions about government. I've been an open source developer way, way longer, starting in the late 90s. Did some hashing and encryption stuff way back then, databases, cloud computing, infrastructure, hardware security, and about 3 years ago had this weird idea as S-bombs were becoming popular, or in the sort of zeitgeist of discussion, how do we really do supply chain traceability, artifact resolution across heterogeneous languages, build tools, supply chains, and open source without burdening developers, without going around and telling an unbounded set of open source projects, volunteers, hey, you need to adopt a bunch of new tools that will cost you either time or money to build these S-bombs. Couldn't we find a finite set, a small set of projects to make changes in, maybe GCC to start with, and then on up the chain from there to Docker build, RPM, et cetera, to connect the dots, as it were, so that the end state, you download a package from PyPy, you download a container from Docker Hub, whatever, that it has a signature and a graph, and gosh, we already have this technology. It's called Git. Underneath Git is a directed acyclic graph of hash identifier maps. Couldn't we repurpose that? Yeah, turns out we can. It wasn't that hard. And you can build this hash map, or what we call an artifact input manifest, at each step in a build process, and then chain it to the next step in someone else's build process. And if everyone did this automatically in our build tools, it wouldn't take more developer effort after we modified the build tools. But at the end of it, you could trace all the way back to the source files and the intermediate steps and the use case if we know that these versions of the log4j package, these file hashes, have a known vulnerability, and you have a Java binary, JVM. You don't know if log4j is in there or what version. You can do some composition analysis, maybe find it. You can look at the SBOM, but today they're not deep enough to tell you that. You can ask your vendor and wait for a response. But if we had the full artifact dependency graph, you could just do a hash lookup. Is this hash in this graph somewhere? And then go, oh, whoops, probably a problem here, or probably safe. The goal is better fidelity information for defense teams. That's my use case. There are others. Other people have come up with for Omnivore. That's
okay,
it.
Thank you.
Thank you. So, Philippe Moedan, for those we are in the room, you have already introduced myself, but the videos will be split. So, I'm the maintainer of many open source tools in the SES space, and I'm the co-creator and creator of something called PackageURL that I represent today. And so, in contrast with what Ava said, I think there's another way to look at things, which is not trying to change the world, but just take it as it is and trying to observe and very modestly trying to extract what we have for that. And so PackageURL, interestingly enough, was really introduced in this very room in 2018. There was a package and dependency management dev room. And it comes from work we did on scan code and the early version of vulnerable code, where we had a very simple problem. We were collecting package data from many different package managers, parsing manifest. We're collecting dependencies. And it was a mess to figure out when a package is named file as a Ruby package, is it the same as file in Debian? Well, it happens, they're completely different. And so what we say then is say, well, Debian file version 1.2.3 is the name of the package. And that's essentially the essence of Perl. And that's all there is to it, not much more. If it's on the Ruby gem, you say gem file 1.2.3. And each of these ecosystems, we call package type, are the ones that are doing the hard work to ensure that the names are mostly unique. And the nice thing, I don't know how it happened, but eventually every tool in the space is using that spec at some level or something which is very close to it. Even the NVD is considering something similar. For instance, database called OSV, in part of the Linux Foundation OpenSSF, and Google is using also Perl. They're also using some of the tools we built around Perl for version range. So it's great. I think it's awesome because it's a way to, even if we don't talk the same language, ensuring that when we talk about a package, we mostly talk about the same thing.
Merci. Hello. I'm Alexios Zavras. Oh, if you don't know me, let me see if I can plug this in again. Right, the slide I had prepared talks about things that you cannot see. Names and locators and identifiers and all this stuff, which might or not be. Yeah, okay, we can do it without, can I?
You have... Go speak, I'm going to try to get your stuff. I know how to get this.
You know?
Yes.
Wonderful. Okay. So when we're talking about naming, as Kate mentioned, right, we have to think about name, locators, and identifiers. And the slide I was prepared to show was that there are two different ways to refer to things. First of all, why do we want to refer to things? We want to refer to things in order to communicate and say, okay, we're all talking about this thing, right? We give them a name, right? Okay. You have an idea why?
It's computers.
Yeah, yeah, devil things. Okay.
It will be discussion.
It will be discussion.
That's fine.
Right. So there are what we're calling intrinsic and extrinsic identifiers. Right. Oh, perfect. Merci, Philippe. Or thank you, everyone. Yeah, don't worry. Okay. You know me. You don't know that. Yeah. Right. So there are... I wanted to show, I took some time to create pictures, right? So there are extrinsic and intrinsic identifiers. Extrinsic rely on a registry or catalog or directory, whatever you want to call it, which keeps the correspondence between the name and the object, right? And intrinsic, there is the connection of the object is inside the name, right? Referring to non-digital world, examples, right, we have ISBNs, right? ISBN is a number, but there is somewhere some database, registry, whatever you want to call it, right, that corresponds a specific book to the ISBN, right? Or a passport ID or something like that. Somebody else keeps the correspondence between the name and the entity, right? And there are intrinsic. And in real, I mean, analog world, non-digital world, right, we have chemical formulas, right? When you're saying natrium chloride, it's sodium chloride, it's salt, right? And this is actually what is the components of the object, right? Or in musical notation, when you see this one, you see that it goes da-da-da-da, and you understand it's Beethoven fifth, right? And there is no registry or directory that gives you the correspondence between these two, right? And on the digital world, as we've already heard, examples are, you know, URLs, URIs, DOIs, PERLs that you just heard, and Omnivore, Gitoid, or whatever, software hash ID. These are based on the content, and there is no. So I'm here because I'm involved with software hash ID, which is an attempt to produce unique IDs for every digital artifact. Right. It's been used in software heritage and the largest archive of source in the world, and it's on its way to become an ISO standard, and it's based, as we heard Eva before, on hashes, on the content, so, you know, it uniquely identifies things based on the actual content.
So let me try to summarize here, okay? The software hash IDs is referencing to a global archive, and you have this starting point.
No, it's not reference archive. Okay. It's the content.
The content in the archive.
No, the content of the... It's the content of the object, right?
Okay, content of the object.
Right. Where you find it, it's a completely different thing, right? But it's how do we call it, right? There is an archive, software heritage archive, and you can find different things.
You can find them there.
You can find them or maybe not find them. It's not... necessary that you will find it there. Our discussion here is about naming, right?
So this is a source of truth for a naming. Mm-hmm. The Omnivore's Gitoids are, here is how I've, things have intermediately been named as they've gone through the build tools.
Very close.
Okay.
Very close. So each of the objects in a build chain, including the final one, get a hash ID. A similar process, slightly different function, but same principle. The difference is we, instead of using the identifier of the object, use the identifier of the build tree behind it to identify it. That's the only functional difference.
And then PERLs are basically representing, oh, I found this, and it may refer to things, in, other things may refer to these and link the PERLs to these.
It's a locator.
Locator.
Yeah, it's a locator and it's also an identifier, and we even summon the authorities on URLs and URIs from W3C to ask whether it was a URL. Okay, and says yes, it's a URL. It's also an identifier. The thing is that it's also something you observe when you have an npm package called React version 2.3. Mm-hmm. That's what you have. So. It's not based strictly on the content, but it's based on the package manifest and way of naming them there.
Okay, good. So I think we're starting to see the hands show up for questions. So just say your question. I'll repeat it for them.
On the one with the hashes, is it...
Which one?
The hash map? The hash ID.
That's both of them.
Okay.
So is it the case that anyone with a proper algorithm can come up with the same result independently? There's no central authority on what?
So the question is, for the hash IDs, can anyone come up with the same result independent and there's no central authority?
Short answer is yes. Both of us use a published, widely known function to derive the hashes. This is why it's called an intrinsic identifier. Given an artifact, a file you found with any name, you can derive the identifier and then look it up somewhere else.
Is the name part of the identifier? Or?
Doesn't have to be.
Is
the name part of the identifier was the question? And not necessarily, right? I can download something off of BitTorrent with a random name. It could be named after a movie star. Doesn't matter, right? And I derive the inherent or intrinsic identifier, look it up on some global database, and realize it's actually an NPM package.
Mm-hmm. Actually, it depends. Right. So do you want the name to be part? Right. If you're talking about, because this is about identifiers for digital artifacts, right? So it's, if it's a file you probably don't care how it's called, so you only look at the content, right? But if it's directory or tree, do you care about the names of the things in there or only the contents? If it's not a directory, if it's only a commit, or it's a revision, or it's a package thing, it's a release, right? So in some cases you care, some cases you don't care. But if we're talking about single files, right, or snippets or something like that, yeah, you don't care about some other names that it has.
Next question.
Governance.
Uh-huh.
Can somebody tell me about the governance about any of these things, such as the Perl spec, or software? How are these being governed? Where are they being developed? Who's issuing them, et cetera?
Okay. I
can answer on Perl. It's a loose coalition of volunteers. I'm going to repeat the question. So what's the governance for these different efforts, and in particular, I'll answer for Perl. So it's the loose governance based on a coalition of willing participants, including folks originally from Microsoft. There were folks from Google. There's folks from Sonatype, from the Cyclone DX project, and folks from ORT and SPDX.
Thank you.
I go there. Eventually, there's been a pressure to get more governance and process in place, which is a good thing, but that's something I like to also do only at the last minute. I'm a proponent of a bit less process whenever possible, and I think most of the developers appreciate a bit less process when possible. So we're considering moving to a non-profit charity, potentially a WASP, and that will mean also adopting at the same time, so a bit more formalized process. So that's the long answer.
Software Hash ID started from the people who built the Software Heritage, right? But right now it's spun out of it. It's run under the community spec governance model, swhid.org. Everyone can contribute, everyone can help, and you know it will follow the process for submitting a spec and becoming a standard. It's a standard.
And Omnibore is in about the same place. It's under the community specification license. There's a website, a calendar, weekly meetings. Anyone who shows up can participate, contribute. The actual governance right now is mostly the regulars are Microsoft or ex-Microsoft and Cisco or ex-Cisco. And other folks from several other companies show up regularly, but there's not a strict governance until it moves into a nonprofit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, next. Go ahead.
Yes, we have many identifiers. Is there a way to convert between some of them or not?
Okay, so the question is, we have many identifiers here. Is there a way to convert between some of them or not? And does, what makes sense? Okay, I'll let
Philippe
start.
Okay, the short answer is yes. And in the end, if you get a checksum on, say, a Zlib archive, that's essentially observing the content. So that's what you would get in a much more sophisticated way with the SWHID or Omnibore. If you know where you got it from, you can get a Perl. If you have a package manifest, you get a Perl. The two are not in conflict, they're complementary. And the last answer I make is that in the things we do on About Code, we have this database where we're tracking both the checksums. We don't track SWH, we track SWHID, but we don't track yet Omnibore. And we have the Perls for all the packages. So eventually there will be public data available to get this kind of mapping and correspondence.
So as you can see from the table, there are two different, it's not easy to always translate, right? The same way, think of it, forget these things. If it's a URL and the text file, right, maybe it's always the same, maybe it has changed, right, you don't know. This relies on a registry. We assume that the registry is responsible and it stays there. These are all based on the content, right? The nice thing is that I think we're using the same algorithm, so these are very easily convertible to each other, right? At least for files or, I mean, the usual things.
I will borrow your phrase, it's complicated. But in this case, I think the short answer is no. Given a Perl, Not all, but some Perls do not contain hash identifiers, only a location. Yeah. If the content at that location is gone or inaccessible to you for some reason, you could not derive and could not translate that Perl into a hash ID. Given either of these hash IDs, you cannot, given only the hash ID, say the Omniore ID or the Solver Heritage ID, you can't just transform it to the other one. You have to go back to the original artifact and rederive the other one. It's math. But there was a lovely research paper done recently on sort of analyzing all of these. And the outcome of that is kind of to say we probably need both at the same time. Because there are certain benefits, use cases, needs that only can be answered from an extrinsic identifier, and some that can only be answered from an intrinsic identifier. And we've got to have a system that supports both at the same time to reference objects.
Okay. So just as one quick word, there's we can do npm install React at 123, or we cannot do today npm install abcd3625, and it's not super expressive. We could. In the end, you may need both. Go ahead. Sorry. Okay. You have questions. There.
Go ahead.
So I'm a license compliance guy, and for me, only for all the three would be perfect. But will we have this information also for commercial components?
Which information?
So the question here is, really like the Omnibor information, and it's good for the compliance side of it, but will we have the information for the commercial components? And will basically people be providing it when they're sending things out, S-bombs in commercially and so forth. Do you have any perspective? Right, yeah. Well, so things that are proprietary and commercial and they're not public, is it possible to use them effectively, efficiently?
Yes. Okay, so the artifact graph that Omnibor uses is content opaque. It's built out of the hash identifier of the content tree, but it doesn't tell you what the source code is. So hypothetically, a company which produces proprietary software could publish both the identifier of the end result and the full hash map of all of its components without telling you what's in it.
They could.
Do they today? No, but they could. And some vendors are looking into doing this.
Okay. He's been patient here, so.
I would say that the dinosaur I'm missing on the slide there is called CPE.
Yeah, thank you. I was going to bring that.
What I would encourage you is to find a similar thing, similar to the aliases in the vulnerabilities area, that you don't have just one system owning the truth, but you can digest multiple ones. I see very, very much a similarity here.
Yeah, I do too. It was very much an elephant in the room, and we will let Philippe talk to it because he's been dealing with it for a while.
So two things there. First, we have to be grateful for CPE to exist.
Yes.
And I remember maybe about a year or ago, I was in a call with folks that included the creator of CPE, and he was apologetic, saying, "I'm really sorry for CPE." He says, "Don't be sorry, man. Nobody was doing anything before you, so be great." Well, it doesn't have to be sorry. So first, let's put things back in perspective. The second thing, it comes from an era where the things people cared for was, is Microsoft Office vulnerable? Is Adobe Acrobat vulnerable? We moved away from that massively, and things are evolving, and that's why we're here. The things about CPE versus other identifiers is that you need to have knowledge that's external to the code. That makes it difficult. Originally, GNU-Zlib was the name for Zlib. Nobody knows why GNU. It's changed since, but there's this difficulty. Each time you have something you cannot observe of the code, it makes things difficult.
Okay, I think we're having to wrap up right now. We're getting pretty close. So if everyone just wants to give me a one-minute summary of what their perspective is here, and then I will let people meet up with the panelists, you know, outside the room, et cetera, if they want to have further discussions. Ava?
Thanks, Kate. Building on what Philippe just pointed out and all of the conversations of the past few days and the last year around the European Commission and the CRA, the world has changed, right? Proprietary software is still super important, but we know that most software in the world, including lots of hardware, the stack is predominantly open source today. And open source is done by volunteers. It's heterogeneous. It's complex. The supply chains are deep. When we try to do analysis, our analysis tools fail because of the fractal nature of our dependency trees. I have yet to see any other proposals for identifiers that also give us visibility down that fractal dependency tree. I would love to see one.
Okay. Just to add on top of this, there's a number of things you can observe, other things you need to discover. And there's two tools which are very useful there, being able to have an index. So index of omnivores as dublished ID. Software Heritage is a small index which has a couple petabytes of code for you there to play with. And the other thing is being able to do lightweight reverse engineering of the binaries that are built will go a very long way. So there's existing techniques. I'm building a bunch of tools in this domain. I think there will be ways to tag and document in the binaries and the more complex piece of code where the code comes from. Rust does it. There's a lot of binary tag also inside Go and other languages. In the end, it's a bit of a wild, wild west right now. There's a transition, as we said, from proprietary only to mostly open source, and this is difficult, and we'll figure out something.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have much to add to this one. We need identifiers, definitely, in order to understand that we're talking about the same things. Right. We have seen there are different ways to approach it, and there are different needs, so you actually need more than one type. Don't think that you will ever get a single thing, right? And, you know, we will figure it out in the end, right?
The problem for tomorrow.
Yes, well, yeah.
This afternoon.
Let's start.
This afternoon.
Yeah, yeah. What are you doing after lunch? Yes.